talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the early history of the Olympic Games, from ancient Greece to the revival in more modern times, as we discuss their historical significance, cultural impact and enduring legacy. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. In tonight's show, we're looking at the early history of the Olympics, from ancient Greece to the revival in 1896 and into the early 20th century, as we uncover the fascinating history and cultural impact of this global phenomenon. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Nigel Crowther is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Classical Studies at the University of Western Ontario. He was also Supervising Professor at the International Olympic Academy at Olympia in Greece and is a former Director of the International Centre for Olympic Studies, and his books include Sport in Ancient Times. Dr. Siobhan Doyle is the curator at the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks and is the author of A History of the GAA in 100 Objects. Dr. Jim Parry is a visiting professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Sport at Charles University at Prague and has been visiting professor of Olympic Studies in Barcelona, Ghent, Ancient Olympia, London and Sochi. He's an expert on sports ethics and social and political philosophy and is the co-author of The Olympic Games Explained. Dr. Nigel Spivey is senior lecturer in classical art and archaeology at the University of Cambridge, and his books include The Ancient Olympics. And you are all very welcome. And Nigel, I might begin with you and a question about the ancient Olympic Games and I suppose the modern version. And how much of the modern reinvention or rediscovery is just playing into a mythology to do with the Olympic Games in terms of the Olympic rings, the torch and all of these symbols that we associate with the modern Olympics? Do they actually have any connection with the ancient Olympic Games?
Well, a lot of the things you've mentioned are indeed modern. There were no second prizes. There were no third prizes. There were no five rings, because the ancient games were not international, and the five rings supposedly represented five continents, according to de Coubertin. One thing we do have in the ancient world is the taking of oaths, and we have the athlete's oath, we have the judge's oath, ancient and modern. And in the ancient world, it was very much associated with religion. It was associated with the god Zeus, the god of the ancient games. And this was very significant, because if you're going to be talking to Zeus, as it were, then you're not going to cheat, maybe. That didn't work, because there was cheating in the ancient world. But yes, I think in answer to your question, I think the ancient games are too often glossed over. These were the glory days. This is when everything was perfect. But I think people are seeing what they want to see. There are not many differences. But I think in the modern world, we do have commercialism, of course, which is added, especially now.
And it's interesting the way, when you look at those ancient games, they were quite aggressive. You know, in some ways, they're almost war by other means in terms of the intensity with which they were competing. And sometimes you had cheating and bribery, and you had, you know, people being hurt and seriously injured in the conflicts. You could almost describe them as conflicts. So it's a very different. If you go back in a time machine, you would see a very different type of competition.
You would indeed. I think some people talk about the ancient games as war without shooting, and they take that expression from George Orwell, of course. But yeah, I think the popular events in the ancient world were boxing and pancration, That's kind of interesting for Ireland, because I think Ireland has more medals in boxing than in other competitions. Brutality was there. Bloodshed was there. The ancients liked this. And in the ancient world, we also had chariot racing and equestrian events. And these were very brutal too, because there's lots of information about crashes, about wrecks of chariots and so forth, head-on crashes. And this was very spectacular. I think the Greeks loved this. So it's blood and gore. And that is something which I think people who don't look into the sources tend to underestimate a little bit.
How long were the Olympic Games in the early years then? Like, was it the extended events that we see now starting this month, or was it something that took place in a much shorter period?
I think when the Games were really established after a few hundred years, and we're going to realize that the ancient Games lasted for over 1,000 years, and I'm pausing here to let you compare the modern Games, which are, what, 128 years or so. I think there are a lot of changes, but we find there are generally 5 days devoted to the Olympic Games. Only 2 of those 5 days, the second and the fourth day, saw sport. What do you see on the other days? You see religion, you see ritual. So there you've got just 2 days out of 5. You don't have several weeks all devoted to sport. Now, if we go back to the very beginnings and the traditional date, which may or may not be correct, is 776 BC, what you find is only one event. And that was called the Stade, which today we'll call the 200 meters. Why do you have just one event, and what did it mean? Well, you have one event because we have runners, all male runners, of course, running a distance of 200 meters to the Temple of Zeus. And it was a way to honor Zeus, a way to honor the gods. Nobody's quite sure exactly why that is true. And if you go to a festival that's got one event, which is 200 meters, and it's going to take, what, 20, 30 seconds, not much of an athletic festival, is it? So why did people go to Olympia? I'm coming back to this word, religion, Zeus, and all the other gods associated with the ancient world. So just to emphasize, 1,000 years or so, lots of changes, 5-day program, only 2 days devoted to sport.
And do we know why they came to an end? Because sometime in the early, is it 6th century AD or so, they stopped happening. Do we know why they didn't continue beyond that time?
Yes, we've got information there, which is a little bit conflicting. In the 4th century, that is the late 300s, or maybe into the 5th century AD, there was a Christian emperor in Rome. And you've got to realize that Greece was part of the Roman Empire at this time. He decreed that all pagan cults should be abolished, temples were destroyed, and that sort of thing. So if you're looking at a nice beginning and end, according to this theory, the Games began with religion and they ended because of religion. But of course there's more. We find physically that there were floods of the Alpheus River, and that sort of flooded the site of Olympia. We also find earthquakes. We also find invaders from the north, the Goths. And also, I think the most recent piece of scholarship suggests that maybe after 1,000 years, the Greeks had changed their mind. Maybe the Olympics had gone out of favor, not quite as popular as they used to be.
We've mentioned cheating. How bad and how serious was cheating in the ancient Olympics? Because we do know, of course, that there is cheating in the modern Games, and especially when it comes to the taking of drugs and various attempts to try and stamp that out. But in the ancient world, what form did cheating take?
As far as we know, I think the primary kind of cheating was bribery. That is, you bribed your opponent. You give your opponent a certain amount of money, and he lets you win. And we know there are many examples of this. The ancient writers talk about this. It is very significant. And it's talked about openly, apparently, especially in later times. If you cheated, theoretically, you could be discovered, of course. If you were discovered, you were punished. You could be punished with whipping, flogging. You could be fined, or you could be excluded from the games. But one other way it could happen is that, and this is my terminology, there was an area at Olympia known as the Hall of Shame, and that is where athletes who are cheated had to erect a statue of Zeus at their own expense. No, we're coming back to religion again, not really part of the modern Olympics.
When you talk about the modern Olympics, is it correct to describe it as a revival, or is it just a complete reinvention? And in other words, is it just something that takes the same name but is completely different? Because when you look at the way the games started again in 1896, it's very different than what had gone before in the ancient world.
It is, and I think that's a difficult question to answer. I think people like de Coubertin would suggest that it was just a continuation. And I should mention here that in the 19th century, there were also Olympic Games before de Coubertin. There were Olympic Games before 1896. For example, there were four Olympics in Athens, in Greece. There were also Olympic Games in Britain at a place called Much Wenlock, which were very, very different from the ancient world. The ones in Greece, of course, were closer. Now, I'd love to answer that question, and you get scholars on both sides, but I think we can say it's really a combination. It's not just a continuation. But we do have politics coming in, commercialism coming in, internationalism coming in, but we don't have women coming in. Not in 1896. Coubertin said of females, their inclusion in the Olympics would be impractical, uninteresting, unaesthetic, and incorrect. And I also want to mention in terms of women that even the marathon, which was not an ancient event, even the marathon did not allow women to participate until Los Angeles in 1984. And that emphasizes the idea that women were not quite able to run such long distances. I think the longest before that was 800 metres.
And Nigel, when you look at Baron de Coubertin, he was a French educator, historian, teacher. What was his ideal? What was his vision for the Games in 1896?
Well, from my point of view, I see that he is interested in the political greatness of France. There was a lot of hostility between France and Germany in the years before the Olympic Games came in. But he was also interested in the educational value of the Olympic Games. And we have now a concept known as Olympism. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this word Olympism, but it is it's kind of philosophy which believes that one should believe in those concepts of understanding, and so forth. So what we have with the Games is a philosophy of life, which the IOC, for example, is often trying to push. It is very much part of the modern Olympics. There are classes on Olympism, the philosophy of life, where it's very different from the Olympic Games as we know it. So what I'm saying is Olympism is one part of the Olympic movement, as they call it, and then on the other hand, you have sport.
Dr. Siobhan Doyle, curator at the National Museum of Ireland, you're very welcome back. And, you know, when we look at the objects that have survived, and some are still in the possession of the families of the athletes and those who were participants, but what has survived in terms of the material and visual culture of those early Olympics?
Well, the Irish Olympic Committee themselves would have quite a strong collection of objects. You're talking medals, documents, pins, jerseys, photographs, because they have those direct connections with the athletes themselves. So we don't actually see that many artefacts of the Olympics within museum collections, because as you mentioned, you know, the Olympics is such a milestone for many athletes, they do tend to hold on to them themselves because they're precious objects. But we do see very small and limited scatterings of objects within the GA Museum collection, within some local museums. I think the Dundalk Museum has an archery medal, and there is a very small amount within our national collection in the National Museum of Ireland. The Olympic Museum in Lausanne in Switzerland, which is of course is the headquarters of the Olympics, of the International Olympics Committee, has a really impressive archive and museum that I suppose is the go-to place for Olympic historians and Olympic fans. And you'll find some objects related to Irish athletes. Actually, in fact, in the entrance, you'll see John Tracy is one of the first photographs that you'll come across in that museum. So there's quite a few in that collection as well. And you can tell, actually, when you visit that museum, that you can tell that the museum itself is on the ground at every Olympics collecting from athletes, not just obvious things like medals and trophies and gear, but things like bobsleighs, and they have boards from the long jump that the winning athletes have signed and that kind of thing. So I suppose that's something that perhaps Irish museums and those of us that are in a position to collect and preserve our Olympic history in this way, we need to start thinking outside the box a bit more.
And remind us of John Tracy, you know, for those of us of my generation will remember him, the long distance running, and as in 1984 he won the silver at Los Angeles, and was one of the iconic athletes in that period.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit before my time, but certainly the highlight of many a reeling in the year or any reels of Irish sports history, let alone Olympic history, an icon of the Irish Olympics, and still very much involved in the movement and within Irish athletics and Irish sports. So his impact on the Olympics has gone far beyond his athletic abilities, as he's been involved in broadcasting and more importantly in as an administrator. So, you know, you can tell his passion by the fact that his involvement outlasted his athletic abilities.
And we're always obsessed by the medals, and we love to see the medals. And have many of the early medals survived?
Yeah, Jack Bates is in the, his silver medal is in the care of the National Gallery of Ireland. I suppose in the early years, there weren't medals. Every participant got a certificate of participation. But I believe it was mostly olive wreaths that were presented. But I suppose it's important to remember Jack Bates, who won our first Olympic medal as Team Ireland. He didn't get his moment on the podium, or, you know, he didn't get presented with his medal. He was notified of his success by a letter in the post.
And Siobhan, tell me about the posters then. Do we have posters that have survived?
Yeah, we do. We've posters from all of the modern Olympic Games, so which are a fascinating piece of research for any design historians. And the posters and the design of the Olympics and the visual representation of it is really important. And that's, I suppose, for the host of the Olympics, it's a thing you really need to get right. It's not just the posters, it's the mascots, it's the merchandise, it's the colours that, you know, goes into that canon of Olympic history. So it's a really important thing for the hosts and the designers to get right. There's been many books on the subject, and I suppose that the posters are quite iconic, and it's fascinating to look through them all and kind of pick your favourite, and the different styles that are very emblematic of the time in which they're designed. Yeah, fascinating for us design historians as well.
Nigel, there's such a mythology around the Olympics, but yet when we go back to the actual original games, you know, as you show in your book, they were pretty much war by other means.
Well, there was a phrase that the writer George Orwell used. I think he'd just seen a football match after the Second World War from, and it was between a team from the Soviet Union and some British team. And the way it was played and the way the spectators were involved, he coined this phrase that sport, you know, had nothing to do with sort of fellowship, but it was, I think his phrase was, it's war minus the shooting. I think what he was doing was, you know, journalistically pinpointing something that armchair psychologists like to talk about, you know, a kind of drive discharge, that we play sports to channel out or channel through our naturally aggressive tendencies. I'm not sure that's still much of a consensus amongst the sports historians, but there is some evidence, I think, in antiquity that that was a justification, if not for the Olympics, at least for a civic maintenance of what, I guess, what we would call gym culture, remembering that the word gymnasium, too, has got Greek roots. If you're a gymnast, you are without your clothes on. But if you look in a Greek lexicon, you'll also find gymnos means you've got no weapons. You've been stripped of weapons. So that's important to remember, I think, that they go to the gym. And they were aware, the Greeks were culturally aware, that stripping off completely was an unusual thing to do. Yeah, other people didn't do this. And it's a moot point as to whether the Romans managed to, you know, they had gyms too, or sometimes they called them palestra, the wrestling places. I think it's unlikely that they completely went naked, nude. So the Greeks were aware that it was a curious thing to do. But at the same time, I think if you remember that you're without weapons, that it's just, you know, what struggling you're doing against your opponent is essentially unarmed struggle. There is this sense that it is that kind of discharge of violent inclinations.
And we have this idealized vision of the ancient games about fairness and sportsmanship and all of that. But actually, when you look at how the losers were treated, I mean, you look at how far people were prepared to go to try and win, they were anything but any kind of ideal.
Yeah, I think the concept of the taking part rather than winning, that is a post-antique mentality. Probably more to do with muscular Christianity and some kind of British public school morality of fair play and such like, which was, you know, that was absorbed by Pierre de Coubertin when he recreated the Olympics for the modern age. I don't know about the Olympic Games themselves, but certainly there are records of athletic meetings elsewhere in the ancient world where spectators were licensed to not only to insult the people who failed to win, but assault them as well, throw things at them and generally jeer them. So in that sense, I think the ethos has changed a good deal. Although I think, okay, we may have tolerated the heroic underdog who performs lamentably but creditably in our eyes. But I think the premium on winning is still pretty much with us. And certainly that was a major feature of the ancient Olympics.
Jim, when we talk about Pierre de Coubertin's vision of the modern Olympics, how much did he draw from the ancient games and how much did he just invent?
Well, he had to invent for modern times, because the sport we know, or modern sport that emerged in the middle of the 19th century, towards the end of the 19th century, was similar to, but not exactly the same as, the kind of sport they had in ancient Greece. So he took as his model ancient Greece, and specifically the notion of contestation, which was widespread in Greek politics and society at the time. And that was the basis also, within a different set of economic and social structures, with the emergence of capitalism and its emphasis on contest and contestation. That's the connection.
And talk to me about the work that you've done in terms of, say, the British Olympic Academy, or being visiting professor of Olympic studies all around Europe at Barcelona, Ghent, London, Sochi, ancient Olympia. How does that kind of try and explain and help us to better understand the world of the Olympics?
Well, I think it helps us to understand better the role of sport in the world today, because with a historical hindsight and vision, we can try to reconstruct what ancient Greek society. And what we find there is that not only sport, what we now call modern sport, that kind of sport, Olympic type sport. Not only that emerged in ancient times in Greece, but also ideals of democracy and philosophy. Philosophy started. Why philosophy? There, why there, why then? Why democracy? And why sport? And one of the answers that a precondition for democratic thinking, a precondition for philosophical thinking, and a precondition for an appreciation of sport is that we adopt an open attitude which accepts the possibility of defeat. This was a huge idea in human and social development, that you might be wrong, that sometimes you have to take a back step, but always try your best to contest. Why? Because out of contest, out of this creative conflict, comes social and personal development. So I become a better sports person if I try to overcome excellent sports persons. That's what contest is about. It's not just beating the other guy because he's your opponent. He's not your enemy. He's your co-facilitator who helps you also to achieve excellence. And these are the commonalities between ancient sport and what we call modern sport.
And it's also interesting the debt that we owe to archaeology, Jim, because if we didn't have the rediscovery of, or the discovery of some of these Olympics, then we wouldn't actually have been able to reinvent them.
This is just astonishing, isn't it? I mean, the Olympic Games, so far as we know, began in 776 BC, and 1,000 years later were erased by the arrival of Christianity. And then we have 1,600 years, during which time the Olympic Games and all kinds of sports and games were frowned upon by the church and were discouraged amongst the population. And not until the emergence of a new competitive spirit in modern capitalism do we see the reemergence of ancient games. And we owe a great debt to especially the Germans who excavated Olympia in the 19th century.
Dr. Nigel Spivey, let's talk about what we can learn by looking at the archaeology, looking at things like sculptures, and how much can we learn about the ancient Olympic Games from those things?
So the German excavation started in the late 19th century in cooperation with the newly sort of independent Greek state. And they're still going on. So there's still lots to dig up at Olympia. And I think it's fair to say that their first high hopes of what they were going to find there are a bit disappointed, in the sense that archaeologists in the 19th century and before were aware of ancient descriptions of Olympia being a magnificent array of statues put up to successful athletes. And the truth is that most of those statues have not come to light. Many of them were made out of bronze. They were melted down and vandalized towards the end of antiquity and even before. But I think what's come to light with the archaeology is a better understanding of what was very mysterious about the beginnings of the games. I mean, we've got this date, notional date, early in the 8th century BC, BCE. But it is very difficult for a historian to say, how did these games just, as it were, materialize at that particular date? Difficult because that is the date from which, essentially, the Greeks measured their own history. And so they weren't really able to give a story of what had happened before. But I think what emerges from the archaeology is a picture of special site, people gathered there, celebrating probably something along the lines of an agricultural kind of, like an agricultural show, really, showing off their breeds and their crops and such like, and having a little bit of leisure. It wasn't as much leisure in the ancient world, arguably, as there is now, but having some leisure to sort of show off their own prowess at running, boxing, whatever. And so the minutiae of dedications at this site, most of the statues have gone, we're left with the bases, but before the statues were being made, you have this sort of practice of votive offerings at the site, and literally thousands and thousands of offerings made by people coming to Olympia. And then it gradually codifies into a kind of process of honoring the god locally, the gods locally, and being codified. And I think Jim has made this point about sport beginning. I mean, sport. You know, someone who's an expert in ancient Egypt will say, they had, they were all Bronze Age cultures. There's evidence of humans doing recreational activities that involve a show of sporting prowess, as we would call it. But I think it is important, as Jim says, that there's a kind of institutional setting up of rules and protocols for how you do this sport that we first see in ancient Greece.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll also talk about the Irish alternative with the Tailteann Games, and we'll find out more about the mythology of those ancient Olympics. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history as we look at the history of the early Olympic Games. Professor Nigel Crowther, can you tell me about the differences between the modern Games or the reinvented Games and the ancient Olympic Games?
First of all, if you look very closely at the Greek word, these were not Olympic Games. They were Olympic contests. And the emphasis was on the agon. That's the Greek word for competition. When you come to the modern world, they are games and everything that implies. So that, I think, is the major difference. Also, if you're looking at a kind of revival, or some people say it's not really a revival or a restoration, I think you've got to take a look at the year. Now, if Coubertin, who was the founder, or one of the founders of the modern Olympics, now, if Coubertin had wanted to keep the sequence of years, then he would have realized that 1896, believe it or not, was not a true Olympic year. Because although the ancient games began in 1776, really, if you divide it by four, of course, that's Olympic games. But the last were 4 BC, the last Olympics BC were 4 BC. The next one was the year one, and therefore it would have been 1897. There are many other differences, and one of them is that the venues, of course, are different. When we take a look at the ancient world, we only have Olympia. The games were always at Olympia. In the modern world, as we all know, they move around from place to place. I think the purpose behind the games was different. We find in the modern world, maybe we've got a political ideal, because Coubertin, the founder of modern games, was interested very much in the political aspect, the greatness of France, and that sort of thing. Whereas in the ancient world, there was very much religion. The ancient games began somehow or other, and this is a little bit vague, in honor of the main god of the Greeks, known as Zeus. So those are a couple of examples. We could go on and on. The events were different, and there is a combination of the ancient and the modern.
And some very interesting links and very significant differences as well. Siobhan, in terms of those early Olympic Games in the modern era, say from 1896 to the end of the 1920s, what do you think stands out in terms of how those games were presented to the world?
I suppose there was much more emphasis on the cultural aspects of the Olympic movement. The Olympics were established as not only a sporting movement, but a cultural one. So you have categories of art, of song, of poetry that shifted to kind of more of a sideshow of the Olympic movement as time went on. The Ireland team were quite successful. So we have Jack B. Yeats winning Team Ireland's first medal for silver for his painting, The Liffey Swim. We have Letitia Hamilton winning bronze in painting as well, and Oliver St. John Gogarty winning bronze for his poetry. And they were as much of a key aspect to the Olympic movement as the sporting events that we're familiar with today.
And how did Ireland becoming independent change things then? Because suddenly we're competing in our own right.
Yeah, and the Olympics were a really important part of Ireland showing on an international stage that we can stand on our own two feet, that we have a newly established Irish Free State, and that we can compete with the world and come out on top. So the Olympics were a platform for Ireland to project their identity and, I suppose, show the world that we're top of the crop in some aspects as well.
The Jack B. Yeats example you gave is extraordinary, though, because if we were doing a show on Jack B. Yeats, we'd be praising his great artworks. We'd be talking about the family connections with William Butler Yeats and the sisters and, you know, the incredible life there. We wouldn't be talking about him as an Olympian.
Yeah.
And it's really an interesting dimension that it shows really how they evolved from the ancient times to the modern times, and then how they evolved from those years into what we have today.
Yeah, and that's kind of what's happened not only with Jack B. Yeats, but with other competitors like some of our other great artists, Sean Keating and other names that we mentioned. You know, the fact that they competed in the Olympics is kind of more of a fun fact, you know, when you look at their biographies and, you know, their successful careers. It's usually just, you know, a footnote or, you know, a very interesting anecdote in the grand scheme of their overall careers. But Ireland's early days in the Olympics were, you know, the whole history is the cultural side of it. And, you know, now that we're 100 years since Team Ireland's first appearance at the Olympics, that's all we're talking about, really, the first medal and the fact that it was won for painting.
So if Ireland was using the Olympic Games in those early years to make a statement about our independence and that we were this newly freed state, then how come then we also had the Tailteann Games, which ran at the exact same time in 1924 and 1928 and 1932, that seemed to be in direct competition?
Yeah, so we have to think about it in the context of the time. So Ireland is just coming out of a very bloody civil war and a very traumatic period for the people of Ireland. And the newly established Irish Free State wanted to have a event, an international event, that would shine Ireland in a positive light. So it would be positive for tourism and to show that Ireland has its own distinct cultural identity, but one that's new and that's modern and international, but also one similar to the Olympics, that it has its ancient roots as well. So the Tailteann Games were similar, a lot of crossovers with the Olympics in that they were both revivals of ancient events. So the Tailteann Games were linked to the Tailteann Games, which took place in County Meath, and they actually predate the Olympic Games. So we'll always have that over the Greeks, that we had our first cultural and sporting mega event before the Olympics.
And why didn't the Tailteann Games succeed? And I'm guessing that they didn't succeed because they didn't continue on. They might have been initially successful, but they didn't last the test of time.
Yeah, there's a few reasons. I suppose primarily it would have been financial. So it's a massive mega event. It took place in 1924, 28 and 32, intentionally to coincide with the Olympics so that the athletes could compete. Some of them were, you know, over this direction in Europe. So you have the 1924 Paris Games, Amsterdam in 28, but in 32, the Games were in Los Angeles. So the athletes weren't as local to Dublin and to Ireland as they would have been the previous two. So there's less of an international dimension to the 1932 Games. And honestly, people just weren't as interested. I think Ireland was suffering from mega event fatigue because we had just held the Eucharistic Congress in Dublin in 1932, like a couple of days before the Tailteann Games. And I think just couldn't justify spending more money on mega events.
And Professor Nigel Crowther, you do see politics intervening in the story of the modern Olympics, because, of course, they have to be cancelled during the First World War and the Second World War. And then you have those Cold War boycotts as well, when the United States and some other countries boycotted the Moscow Olympics in 1980 because of the invasion of Afghanistan. And then you see the Soviet Union responding then in 1984, boycotting the Olympics in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. I mean, they did not continue. The Olympic Games did not continue through wars. And I think we should add that the games in the ancient world, if I may go back to my specialty, the games in the ancient world were not international. And this fits in very nicely with what we've been talking about with Ireland. And that is, the ancient games were very much national. They were Greeks who competed and no other country. And therefore, when we come to the modern world, we find it's all about countries. It's all about the USA against Russia. Politics comes in from the very beginning in 1896 because Coubertin, or de Coubertin, to give him his better title, de Coubertin wanted the games not to be in Athens, but in Paris, because he was interested in the greatness of France. And first Olympic Games after 1896, of course in 1900, were indeed in Paris. And that is no coincidence. And as we have mentioned 100 years ago, they were also in Paris. That is indeed when Ireland first participated. And I think we should also mention that we right now are talking about the modern Olympic Games in terms of the summer events. Obviously, because the summer events are arriving, but the winter events are very important. The winter events are important today, but not so in the ancient world because they didn't exist. The Winter Olympics began in the year we've just been talking about, 1924, and the Winter Olympics are very important for countries like Canada because in Canada, the Winter Games are more significant than the Summer Games. Why? Because Canada wins so many gold medals in the Winter Games in terms of, say, hockey and curling and so forth.
No, that is a fascinating difference. And it is interesting that when we talk about the Olympic Games, certainly here in this side of the world, we think of the Summer Games every 4 years. We don't think of the Winter Olympics. And perhaps if we were like Canada getting all these medals in the Winter Olympics, we would think of it more in those terms. But it is interesting that in the popular imagination, it's very much associated with the Summer Games. And the Winter Games themselves, I think, only began in 1924. So they were also a later addition to the story.
Absolutely right. And this would be particularly true for Ireland. I don't think Ireland has won a medal in the Winter Games, but they have won 11, I think, 11 gold medals in the Summer Games. So obviously, the Summer Games are more important there. In the ancient world, of course, we don't have Winter Olympics for obvious reasons, but I think we should remember that certain countries like Norway are more interested in the Winter Games because they are so popular in Scandinavia.
And I'm very struck by what you're saying there about how the countries monitor how many medals they've won. And I've been over in the United States sometimes when the Olympics are on and you see them always reporting on the medal tally and who's leading the race to win the most medals of different colours and so on. And that does seem to be very different from the early ideals of the Olympics, doesn't it? Where it's about inclusivity and promoting well-being, promoting peace, most importantly, an international understanding. And you're not really promoting all of this when it becomes very much a contest between countries to see who's the best.
Well, that's the difference. You're talking about international understanding, brotherhood and peace, a kind of motto of the Olympics. But certainly today it's sport, and sport implies competition. And that's what we have in the modern world. In the United States, in Canada, it's all about, you might call it politics, but it's all about winning. So you're absolutely right in terms of nationalism, competition, winning is everything.
Siobhan, when we think of Irish women at the Olympic Games, we think most recently of Kelly Harrington and Katie Taylor and Annalise Murphy, and maybe before that, more controversially, Michelle Smith. But when we go back to those early days of the revived modern Olympics, how involved were women in it, and what was the involvement of Irish women?
Not very much at all. We have to remember that sport was something that was invented by men for men. So, you know, when we look not just at the Olympics, but more widely, it's something that women have to insert themselves into. And I suppose at the time of the first revived Olympics, you know, there wasn't much opportunities for women outside the home and outside the family sphere. So there certainly wasn't much room for them in the Olympics. The first women that we see competing at the Olympics is in 1900. And there's no Irish women. And there's only 22 women in total competing. So it's, I think, something about 4% of the entire athletes were women. And they were competing in categories like croquet, like equestrian, and golf and tennis. So these kind of sports that were seen to be, I suppose, more ladylike than others. You know, women had to cover up and they couldn't be seen to exert themselves. The first time that we see women competing in athletics is in 1928 in Amsterdam. And that didn't go down well. Women were competing in the 800 metres. And safe to say the men weren't pleased. They were so horrified by seeing the women exert themselves that much that they were taken off the Olympic schedule and came back again some years later. But yeah, we don't see Irish women competing until the 1920s, 1930s. And then we have people like you mentioned, Michelle Smith and Katie Taylor blazing a trail. And I suppose one unforgotten woman, well, I would consider her forgotten, is Letitia Hamilton from Dunboyne in County Meath. And she was the only woman to win an Olympic medal for Ireland at the 1948 Olympics. And that was for painting. And the painting categories had to have a sporting theme. So she painted the Meath point-to-point races and she won a bronze medal. And we don't know where that painting is now. So it won, you know, it's up there in our medal table and its location is unknown. It's thought that it may be in a private collection in the USA. But because there was very limited documentation of those categories, of particularly the cultural and the artistic ones, it's going to be a tough one to track down. I don't think I've seen a photograph of the sketches of the piece, but never seen the painting. And it's just a real shame because it's an incredibly important part of our Olympic history that we don't even have, you know, a visual idea of what it is.
And given the success of Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington, it is amazing that it was only in 2012 at the London Olympics that you see boxing as the last sport that was included in women's events.
Yeah, and that was always, I think, from Katie Taylor's early days, that was always an aspiration of hers to compete for Ireland in the boxing categories. And thankfully, she saw that happen and she did it with a bang. And yeah, this is the first Olympics that we have complete gender parity at. So we have the same amount of women and men competing in categories across both genders. So we've come a long way. There's still a bit more to go just in terms of coverage of women's sport. But certainly the Olympics is a place where, you know, you could argue the most gender parity in terms of how women are covered by the media and in garnering excitement as well.
Very good. Well, tonight we are talking about the history of the Olympics from ancient times to the modern revival. We could take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the legacy of the Olympic Games. Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the ancient Olympics and their modern revival. I'm rejoined by Dr. Jim Parry, visiting professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Sport at Charles University in Prague, founding director of the British Olympic Academy, and he's the co-author of The Olympic Games Explained, and Dr. Nigel Spivey, senior lecturer in classical art and archaeology at the University of Cambridge, who's the author of The Ancient Olympics. Jim, can we talk about, I suppose, the modern Olympics and the controversies and I suppose the way the games are in some ways still this great ideal and in other ways there's always these suspicions and taints around them. How do you view the modern Olympics and the challenges they face?
The most positive thing is a celebration of all of humanity. Now, of course, there are going to be problems with that. There'll be political difficulties between, I mean, the Palestinians don't want the Israelis to take part, and there are problems with ecological damage in Paris. And so all the problems of the world, it seems, are reflected in, discussed in the context of the Olympic Games. And this is a marvelous thing because it makes sport a vector of human interest and desires. So when you see arguments about racism or transgender issues, in what venue are they discussed these days? Answer, sport mainly. And the more elite the sport can be, the more these questions are raised. And I think this is evident of sport as a conveyor of human values. And so one of the great things of institutionalized modern sport is that it requires us to face ourselves as human beings in the context of white-hot competition, to restrain ourselves, to discipline ourselves, to organize ourselves, and to behave morally. I think this is one of the great virtues of modern sport, especially in the context of the Olympics.
And you've argued that perhaps the Olympic Games could be scaled back, or certainly in the way that they're hosted and presented, and they could be organized and run in a better way.
Oh, there's no doubt at all about that. If you look at the 26 or 28, depends how you count, sports in the Summer Olympics, you'll find that they were codified first in France or England in the late 19th century. I mean, they haven't moved on for over a century. And I think it's time now to reevaluate the Olympic program. It should be scaled down, and elitist and Western-centered sports, we should think about getting rid of them. And there are other arguments. Weightlifting is not a rational sport. Boxing is where you try to cause others damage. Sailing, too expensive, is it? Can we find a cheaper way of doing it? Rowing. Very few African and Asian countries do rowing. Okay, so we can find ways of team games. Why have football at the Olympic Games when there's a World Cup and FIFA insists on not sending its best to the Olympics? They have a cap on players over 23. They ought to be banned, because the Olympics is supposed to be for the best. So then you'll end up with a set of sports which are more or less universal, which everybody can have a go at, which don't cost too much, and then we can start to introduce a few sports from Asia and from Africa maybe, and from South America, sports that Europeans don't play. Let's see Europeans play with the rest of the world, as well as the rest of the world playing European sports.
And finally, Jim, I'll leave the last word to you. In terms of the Olympics this summer, and in terms of how we should approach it, why do you think the Olympics should matter, and why do you think they do matter so much?
Someone once defined games as the voluntary attempt to overcome unnecessary obstacles. Well, that's the pole vault for you. Nobody has to do it, right? It's totally unnecessary, but we devote ourselves to it. The same's true with that's performance sports, when you have to repeatedly practice and execute some particular performance. But there are also games sports like football and basketball and so on, and they also have a gratuitous logic. That's to say, we do them for no good reason, and we put unnecessary obstacles in our way just so that we can overcome them. And I think this essence of games and game playing is the most important thing. It reminds us of our humanity and of our common humanity.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Jim Parry, visiting professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Sport at Charles University at Prague, Dr. Nigel Spivey, senior lecturer in classical art and archaeology at the University of Cambridge, and earlier, of course, Dr. Siobhan Zoyle, curator at the National Museum of Ireland at Collins Barracks, and Professor Nigel Crowther, emeritus professor in the Department of Classical Studies at the University of Western Ontario. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Hannah Flam on research. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.